She waded out until the bottom sloped away steeply under her feet, and she found herself forced to swim. She broke into an awkward breaststroke, hampered by her skirts and her injured arm. However, her slow and stealthy movements created almost no disturbance on the surface, and before the men on the road had reached the point where she had descended the bank, she reached a dense stand of reeds. She eased her way into the thick of them and let herself sink. Before the water covered her nostrils, she felt her toes touch the soft ooze of the lake bottom. She stood there quietly, with just the top of her head above the surface, and her face turned away from the bank. She knew her dark hair would not reflect the light of a probing torch. Though the water covered her ears, she could make out the excited voices of the men on the road. They had turned their torches down towards the water and were shining them into the reeds, searching for her. For a moment one of the beams played full on her head, and she drew a deep breath ready to submerge. But the beam moved on, and she realized that they had not picked her out. The fact that she had not been seen, even in the direct torchlight, emboldened her to raise her head slightly until one ear was clear and she could make out their voices. They were speaking Arabic, and she recognized the voice of the one named Bakshit. He appeared to be the leader, for he was giving the orders. "Go in there, Yusuf, and bring the whore out." She heard Yusuf slipping and sliding down the bank, and the splash as he hit the water. "Further out," Bakshit ordered him. "Into those reeds there, where I am shining the torch." "It is too deep. You know well I cannot swim. It will be over my head." "There, right in front of you, in those reeds, I can see her head." Bakshit encouraged him, and Rayan dreaded that they had spotted her. She sank down as far as she could below the surface. Yusuf splashed around heavily, moving towards where she cowered in the reeds. Then suddenly there was a thunderous commotion that startled even Yusuf, so that he shouted loudly, "Jinns, God protect me!" as the flock of roosting duck exploded from the water and launched into the dark sky on noisy wings. Yusuf started back to the bank, and not any of Bakshit's threats could persuade him to continue the hunt. "The woman is not as important as the scroll," he protested, as he climbed back onto the roadway. "Without the scroll, there will be no money. We always know where to find her later." Turning her head slightly, Royan saw the torches move back down the road towards the parked Fiat, whose headlights still burned. She heard the doors of the car slam, and then the engine revved and pulled away towards the villa. She was too shaken and terrified to make any attempt to leave her hiding place. She feared that they had left one of their number on the road to wait for her to show herself. She stood on tiptoe with the water lapping her lips, shivering more with shock than with cold, determined to wait for the safety of the sunrise before she moved. It was only much later when she saw the glow of the fire lighting the sky and the flames flickering through the trunks of the palm trees that she forgot her own safety and dragged herself back to the bank. She knelt in the mud at the water's edge, shuddering and shaking and gasping, weak with loss of blood and shock and the reaction from fear, and peered at the flames through the veil of her wet hair and the lake water that streamed into her eyes. "The villa," she whispered. "Durayed. Oh, please, God. No. No." She pushed herself to her feet and began to stagger towards her burning home. Bakshit switched off both the headlights and the engine of the Fiat before they reached the turning into the driveway of the villa and let the car coast down and stop below the terrace. All three of them left the Fiat and climbed the stone steps to the flagged terrace. Jurayed's body still lay where Bakshit had left it beside the fish pond. They passed him without a glance and went into the dark study. Bakshit placed the cheap nylon tote bag he carried on the tabletop. "We have wasted too much time already. We must work quickly now." "It is Yusuf's fault," protested the driver of the Fiat. "He let the woman escape." "You had a better chance on the road," Yusuf snarled at him, "and you did no better." "Enough," Bakshit told them both. "If you want to get paid, then there had better be no more mistakes." With the torch beam, Bakshit picked out the scroll that still lay on the tabletop. That is the one, he was certain, for he had been shown a photograph of it, so that there would be no mistake. They want everything, the maps and photographs, also the books and papers, everything on the table that they were using in their work. Leave nothing. Quickly they bundled everything into the tote bag, and Bakshit zipped it closed. Now, the Doktari, bring him in here. The other two went out onto the terrace and stooped over the body. Each of them seized an ankle and dragged Duraid back across the terrace and into the study. The back of Duraid's head bounced loosely on the stone steps at the threshold, and his blood painted a long, wet skid mark across the tiles that glistened in the torchlight. Get the lamp, Bakshit ordered, and Yusuf went back to the terrace and fetched the oil lamp from where Duraid had dropped it. The flame was extinguished. Bakshit held the lamp to his ear and shook it. Full, he said with satisfaction, and unscrewed the filler cap. All right, he told the other two. Take the bag out to the car. As they hurried out, Bakshit sprinkled paraffin from the lamp over Duraid's shirt and trousers, and then he went to the shelves and splashed the remainder of the fuel over the books and manuscripts that crowded them. He dropped the empty lamp and reached under the skirts of his dishdasha for a box of matches. He struck one of them and held it to the wet run of paraffin oil down the bookcase. It caught immediately, and flames spread upwards and curled and blackened the edges of the manuscripts. He turned away and went back to where Duraid lay. He struck another match and dropped it onto his blood and paraffin-drenched shirt. A mantle of blue flames danced over Duraid's chest. The flames changed colour as they burned into the cotton material and the flesh beneath it. They turned orange, and sooty smoke spiralled up from their flickering crests. Bakshit ran to the door, across the terrace and down the steps. As he clambered into the rear seat of the Fiat, the driver gunned the engine and pulled away down the driveway. The pain roused Duraid. It had to be that intense to bring him back from that far place on the very edge of life to which he had drifted. He groaned. The first thing he was aware of as he regained consciousness was the smell of his own flesh burning, and then the agony struck him with full force. A violent tremor shook his whole body, and he opened his eyes and looked down at himself. His clothes were blackening and smouldering, and the pain was as nothing as he had ever experienced in his entire life. He realized in a vague way that the room was on fire all around him. Smoke and waves of heat washed over him, so that he could barely make out the shape of the doorway through them. The pain was so terrible that he wanted it to end. He wanted to die then, and not have to endure it further. Then he remembered Royan. He tried to say her name through his scorched and blackened lips, but no sound came. Only the thought of her gave him the strength to move. He rolled over once, and the heat attacked his back that up until that moment had been shielded. He groaned aloud and rolled again, just a little nearer to the doorway. Each movement was a mighty effort and evoked fresh paroxysms of agony, but when he rolled onto his back again, he realized that a gale of fresh air was being sucked through the open doorway to feed the flames. A lungful of the sweet desert air revived him and gave him just sufficient strength to lunge down the step onto the cool stones of the terrace. His clothes and his body were still on fire. He beat feebly at his chest to try to extinguish the flames, but his hands were black, burning claws. Then he remembered the fish pond. The thought of plunging his tortured body into that cold water spurred him to one last effort, and he wriggled and wormed his way across the flags like a snake with a crushed spine. The pungent smoke from his still cremating flesh choked him, and he coughed weakly but kept doggedly on. He left slabs of his own grilled skin on the stone coping as he rolled across it and flopped into the pond. There was a hiss of steam, and a pale cloud of it obscured his vision so that for a moment he thought he was blinded. The agony of cold water on his raw, burned flesh was so intense that he slid back over the edge of consciousness. When he came back to reality, through the dark clouds. He raised his dripping head and saw a figure staggering up the steps at the far end of the terrace, coming from the garden. For a moment he thought it was a phantom of his agony. But when the light of the burning villa fell full upon her, he recognised Royan. Her wet hair hung in tangled disarray over her face, and her clothing was torn and running with lake water and stained with mud and green algae. Her right arm was wrapped in muddy rags, and her blood oozed through, diluted pink by the dirty water. She did not see him. She stopped in the centre of the terrace and stared in horror into the burning room. Was Duryed in there? She started forward, but the heat was like a solid wall and it stopped her dead. At that moment the roof collapsed, sending a roaring column of sparks and flames high into the night sky. She backed away from it, shielding her face with a raised arm. Duryed tried to call to her, but no sound issued from his smoke-scorched throat. Royan turned away and started down the steps. He realized that she must be going to call for help. Duryed made a supreme effort, and a crow-like croak came out between his black and blistered lips. Royan spun round and stared at him, and then she screamed. His head was not human. His hair was gone, frizzled away, and his skin hung in tatters from his cheeks and chin. Patches of raw meat showed through the black crusted mask. She backed away from him as though he were some hideous monster. "Royan," he croaked, and his voice was just recognizable. He lifted one hand towards her in appeal, and she ran to the pond and seized the outstretched hand. "In the name of the Virgin, what have they done to you?" she sobbed. But when she tried to pull him from the pond, the skin of his hand came away in hers in a single piece, like some horrible surgical rubber glove, leaving the bleeding claw naked and raw. Royan fell on her knees beside the coping and leaned over the pond to take him in her arms. She knew that she did not have the strength to lift him out without doing him further dreadful injury. All she could do was hold him and try to comfort him. She realized that he was dying. No man could survive such fearsome injury. "They will come soon to help us," she whispered to him in Arabic. "Someone must see the flames. Be brave, my husband. Help will come very soon." He was twitching and convulsing in her arms, tortured by his mortal injuries and racked by the effort to speak.
"The scroll."
His voice was barely intelligible. Royan looked up at the holocaust that enveloped their home, and she shook her head. "It's gone," she said. "Burned or stolen."
"Don't give it up," he mumbled. "All our work."
"It's gone," she repeated. "No one will believe us without..."
"No."
His voice was faint but fierce.
"For me, my last..."
"Don't say that," she pleaded. "You will be all right."
"Promise," he demanded. "Promise me."
"We have no sponsor. I am alone. I cannot do it alone."
"Harper," he said.
Royan leaned closer so that her ear touched his fire-ravaged lips.
"Harper,"
he repeated.
"Strong, hard, clever man."
And she understood then. Harper, of course. Harper was the fourth and last name on the list of sponsors that he had drawn up. Although he was the last on the list, somehow she had always known that Duryed's order of preference was inverted. Nicholas Quentin Harper was his first choice. He had spoken so often of this man with respect and warmth, and sometimes even with awe. "But what do I tell him? He does not know me. How will I convince him? The seventh scroll is gone."
"Trust him,"
he whispered.
"Good man. Trust him."
There was a terrible appeal in his
"Promise me."
Then she remembered the notebook in their flat at Giza, in the Cairo suburbs, and the Taita material on the hard drive on her PC. Not everything was gone.
Yes, she agreed. I promise you, my husband. I promise you.
Though those mutilated features could show no human expression, there was a faint echo of satisfaction in his voice as he whispered,
"My flower."
Then his head dropped forward, and he died in her arms. The peasants from the village found Royan still kneeling beside the pond, holding him, whispering to him. By that time, the flames were abating, and the faint light of dawn was stronger than their fading glow.